Hello, this time on SITREP, Australia, the UK and the US have a multi-billion pound plan for submarine supremacy in the Asia Pacific and closer to home. A new generation of British designed submarines powered by US nuclear technology. 4 years since the AUKUS deal was struck, storm clouds are gathering in the distance. It's under review in the US. Australian opponents are complaining about cost and transparency, and there are warnings from a UK watchdog about the deliverability of these next generation attack subs. Ministers say, so far, everything's on track. But what if these concerns do materialise into very real problems? We explain the potential pitfalls, how they can be navigated, plus what's at stake for our military capability and that of our key allies.
Unique to Australia, diesel electric submarines no longer are fit for purpose.
This will dramatically build our capability and our sovereignty.
Defence Explained.
We have the technology and the designs to be able to deliver our commitments to the SSN AUKUS, and we will.
If we fail, it's because we have fundamentally failed to fulfil our basic defence and security objectives.
This is SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Well, as we speak, MPs from the Commons Defence Committee are in Australia on a fact-finding trip as they navigate how the AUKUS programme is shaping up. Mike, the fact that they've travelled across the world illustrates, doesn't it, how important AUKUS is to our defence and the fact they can see the potential for this going wrong.
Yes, it could be a big moment. I mean, when the AUKUS deal was announced, I mean, the government said it was a landmark deal, and it was, not just in military and industrial terms, but in strategic terms as well. And if you look at what the government says about our future positioning, of course, we're concentrating on the defence of Europe, but AUKUS is one of the major elements. So, you know, we are NATO first, and then AUKUS is the centrepiece of our commitment to the Indo-Pacific and to our allies. And because it's between Australia, the United States and Britain, it represents three of the closest military allies. So, you know, if this deal goes down, it won't just be a problem for defence and for industry. It'll be a pretty big problem for our strategic orientation on the world scene. So it's big stuff.
And we are asking a lot of what ifs today, but what we want to do is understand those risk factors, their potential consequences, and how problems could be avoided or at least mitigated. And to help us do that, we welcome Sophia Gaston, Senior Research Fellow at King's College London Department of War Studies. She also serves as a government advisor and has given expert evidence to the Defence Committee's inquiry into AUKUS. And we welcome back Tom Sharp, whose time in the Royal Navy included not only command of four warships, but also nearly 3 years as a military planner at Permanent Joint Headquarters. Hello to both of you. Thank you for joining us on SITREP. Tom, when the deal was done, it was hailed as great news for British defence industry. But AUKUS is also about our own future maritime capability, not just that of Australia, isn't it?
It is. The great news and the cynicism arrived at almost exactly the same time. We're talking about such a vast change here. I mean, building nuclear submarines is very hard, as we've proven through our own Astute class. Americans have fallen behind on their Virginia class. Just building nuclear submarines is hard. If you then make that a trilateral arrangement with one country who hasn't built nuclear submarines before, you can see why the sort of diehard cynics really kind of blanched almost from the off. But to me, AUKUS is something that we have to make work. It has to succeed in some form or other. In order from a UK perspective, if we're to provide follow-ons for the Astute class submarines that I mentioned, then AUKUS has to work. So we have to continue to fund it and ensure that those arrangements, international arrangements, remain in place to blast away the naysayers and the cynicism using money if necessary.
Sophia, there have been important steps forward on paper in the last 4 years. The UK's updated its status of forces agreement with Australia, for example. The US has signed off on key technology exports. So what's your assessment of the state of the AUKUS programme and the level of risk to the many steps still ahead?
It's certainly true that there has been significant progress on some of the really vital underpinnings of the AUKUS pact, which really are legislative and regulatory. And we shouldn't downplay the significance of those advancements. That said, I do think that we have to come back to the central challenge that AUKUS is trying to address, which is really around this asymmetrical advantage that China has been amassing in terms of its military development and the threat that that poses, not just to United States, but all Western allies. And so really this objective around this sort of collective uplift and collective capability that can really challenge and hopefully exceed China's capabilities, that requires us delivering on pace and mass. And I think one of the problems is that, you know, AUKUS is a very disruptive project. It's a very modern project, and it requires us moving a lot faster and certainly not business as usual on any element of this project delivery. And if we don't move into that extremely ambitious posture and start getting some runs on the board in terms of delivery, then we're going to fail at that deterrence objective and that capability uplift.
So delivering at pace and en masse, let's take the big concerns one by one, starting with the US review and talk that it might not sell Australia three Virginia-class submarines. Just explain the issue here, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, as we've said, I mean, this whole program requires all three nations, even the United States, to do better than they've done so far on submarine design and building. And in the US, they've got the same sort of problems of delivering new submarines as we have. They're different problems. But again, their amber lights are flashing on their program evaluations, just as our amber lights are flashing on ours, which doesn't mean to say that they're in crisis, but they've got to do better than they're doing now. And so the US has got two reasons. One is that they're not sure they can produce enough the Virginia-class subs that they need, or their new subs that they need, to transfer three Virginia-class subs to Australia, and potentially another two. So it's three in the agreement with the possibility of five eventually. They're not sure that they'll have enough coverage themselves to make that transfer. But then the reason they don't talk about is the fear of entanglement, because you've got to realise that behind this are some key people. And I think their scepticism isn't just about their own build programme. It's about an arrangement which entangles the United States when the US is getting further and further into an isolationist mindset. And that's the reason they don't talk about. And I think it may be the thing that is most critical to their review of AUKUS, which is due now, in fact.
Okay, then, Sophia, what if the US does renege on selling Virginia-class subs to kickstart things? What then?
Well, firstly, I would just like to add on the Pentagon-led review of AUKUS. I think we are actually still on track. They did update the timeline to delivery in the autumn. We are technically still in there. I think that there is very good reason to believe that AUKUS will actually not just survive the Trump administration, but could actually be given a lot more attention under the Trump administration if it is embedded properly within this new strategic framework. So I think I do want to just calm nerves, because I know there is a lot of anxiety about this at the moment. That said, it is absolutely true that the political resilience element of AUKUS was completely underpriced at the beginning of this. But I do think that these risks will remain over the course of the project. And I think, you know, one thing that has been revealed from this process is that it's not sufficient to not have any plan Bs on what to do. And I think there was certainly a feeling that Canberra had put itself in a position where it didn't really have many other options if that decision was to be taken. So I would assume that that work will now be done.
But then, Sophia, what is the plan B if the US reneges on selling Virginia-class subs?
Well, I think you have to look at this, you know, it's a trilateral arrangement. Obviously, Britain is actually taking the lead on the SSN AUKUS, and there is a bilateral component to that entire endeavor. But I think there are also, you know, we are seeing from the South Koreans, the Japanese, a lot more interest and engagement in shipbuilding and also getting involved in nuclear shipbuilding. So I think there are possible other allied workarounds. That said, I think while coming up and exploring other possible plan B solutions, you and very much want to invest in actually persuading the United States that this is in their direct national interest and entirely compatible with America First, because that does remain the best possible medium-term opportunity.
Tom, is there an option to extend the UK and US rotations through Perth?
If the Virginias don't make it, there is no, the plan B is a hot mess, right? Of sort of hodgepodge solutions, whether they start negotiating older US submarines that they can take, whether or not we lease one of our A boats. I mean, if we don't do UK first, but if we were to start calling in those terms, we would not want to give away one of our very precious and not so available SSNs to Australia right now. Absolutely not. But that's, going to be part of this conversation. Then you start looking at rapid purchase of SSKs. I mean, that's a huge backward step, but we're talking about it in this country. We are using the sort of the language of that was banned through my time. We need mass, we need experience, and we've lost both. So SSK purchase, rapid SSK purchase. I mean, firstly, there is no such thing, but it's quicker than AUKUS. And then you get into the uncrewed bit, right? What's the substitute here? What are the uncrewed technological parts of this that could ameliorate delay or absence of Virginias? But it's all messy. I mean, and it sets all the programs back a considerable distance. So I can see why they don't have a clearly articulated plan B, because none of it looks good.
Just explain SSK, will you, Tom, please?
Yeah, so this is a very important point as to why Australia need SSKs in the first place. So an SSK is a diesel electric submarine. It's powered by a combination of both. It's powered by the batteries through the propeller. And those batteries, obviously, like all batteries, run out. And then at that point, you need to recharge them through the diesel power. Diesel engines, of course, they need air to breathe. That requires the submarine to come to near the surface. This is the Achilles heel of SSKs. They are very quiet when they're operating on their batteries, but they have to come up and run their diesels, which is called snorting, and they make a racket when they do that, and they become much, much more vulnerable to satellite and radar detection.
And Mike, we know that in the next couple of years now, the UK and US are due to start rotating subs to operate from Perth as a first measure. How much of an ask is that for the Royal Navy already? Because the Astute class has had a lot of problems.
It has. And having a boat going in and out of Perth will be a big requirement. It's one that the Navy wants to take on for sure, for all sorts of, good strategic reasons. But as Tom said, I mean, these are precious. Our Astute boats, SSNs, are not something we've got too many of. And they've got their own maintenance problems because they're a very advanced design. So, as we said before, this is something that requires all of the partners to step up. So already we've got now to contemplate doing something that's going to make us feel uncomfortable from a resource point of view in order to make AUKUS work. And the Navy has absolutely got to be ready to step up for this, because we don't want to do anything which looks as if it might increase the chances that the program will be changed or even cancelled.
Okay, the next what if is the possibility that building the new SSN AUKUS submarines doesn't go to plan. Sophia, first contracts have been signed with BAE, Rolls-Royce and Babcock for design and some long lead purchases. We also know the government's major projects review has an amber warning on the submarine programme and red warning on the nuclear core capability. Why?
I think, every one of us is experiencing these challenges in our submarine industrial pipeline. There's not really, any power that is not having some challenges in this. It's a complex, really complex project. It takes a lot of time. We have an essentially monopolistic supply chain with some, there's challenges around redundancies in that supply chain. So, if things go wrong, it's difficult to mitigate them sometimes. Now, I would say, I think a lot of investment have been made since, with the Dreadnought program on trying to, improve some of that and making sure that particularly BAE and Rolls are able to work together, and there's a lot more visibility around timelines and delivery and accountability and so on. But the fact remains, we have very few suppliers, and we also have demands on a highly skilled technical workforce, which is always extremely challenging to not just recruit, but to retain. I think one thing I would say, stepping back, is again, one of the other things that was underpriced with AUKUS is it's never really been prosecuted in the UK as a national mission. But for us to really go all in on uplifting our submarine and industrial pipeline, you have to have a whole of government approach to dealing with some of the challenges in the Barrow enterprise. You know, I think BAE has done an outstanding job at rebuilding that workforce from its real nadir in the early noughts. But, you know, you need the full suite of government levers around infrastructure, education, housing, etc., to be able to be pulled to actually deal with this and kind of grow a really robust, sustainable workforce. So I think on a number of levels, we have, you know, some pretty obvious vulnerabilities in the system. I think we can be confident that things are starting to move in the right direction on that. And certainly there is the formation of a new kind of submarine production agency that is going to oversee this new trilateral endeavor between the MOD and these two key industry players. But I think, you know, you'd be wanting to do a pretty rapid auditing exercise of the resilience of that supply chain and the workforce. And actually, you really need the Prime Minister leading from the top to say, okay, we're going to put all the resources available to actually go at this. I think, you know, while of course AUKUS is about our Indo-Pacific commitments and supporting our core Indo-Pacific ally in Australia, these SSN AUKUS boats are also necessary for our own home region. This is about the Euro-Atlantic as much as it's about the Indo-Pacific. Mm. So these questions about AUKUS as a discrete project failing really should be questions about, you know, can we support and ensure our vital national security? Because that's what this capability is getting at.
So, to that point, when are the AUKUS subs supposed to come into service with the Royal Navy, Tom? And what happens if they're delayed?
Well, we'll end up in the same, we'll just perpetuate the problem we have now and have done with every class of ship for the last 30 years, where the development is late, the existing boats are asked to run on. I mean, you look at our deterrent class submarine, Vanguard class submarines coming back now from 203-day patrols. You know, they've changed colour. They've been at sea for so long. And if we don't get AUKUS running along its current timelines, that's what will happen. I mean, the SDR didn't commit to very much. It was remarkable that in the midst of that was a commitment to 12 nuclear submarines. I think that caught everyone slightly by surprise and was, again, immediately followed by the cynics going, well, we just don't have the money. And I think, you know, this to me is the problem here. The reason our nuclear infrastructure and our nuclear submarines are in the state they're in is because for 30 years, we've been running the most complex enterprise on the planet on a shoestring. You know, what we're sensing now is a shift in rhetoric and a shift in conversation. But gosh, that's a long way from stumping up the cash and building nuclear powered submarines.
So, Mike, what would be the operational impact of a delay to AUKUS for the Royal Navy?
Well, there'd be a lot of workarounds, which ultimately would be, you know, less efficient. I mean, as Sophia was saying, you can think of different workarounds that might be created, but all of them are suboptimal. But they'd be better than letting the program collapse or being responsible for the program's collapse. So for the Royal Navy, it would just be harder work doing visits. We're supposed to get involved in visits from 2027 from changing the operational tempo and so on. But we'd end up doing more of that while we tried to think about other options for different types of submarine or different types of program. But it would be a bit of a nightmare, but not as big a nightmare as seeing the whole program go down.
And I'll raise our detra, right, as a maritime nation. If you just keep paring away all the tasks that we need to do in order to create that deterrent effect, it doesn't take long before you end up with the Greenland Lights and UK gap northeast of that and bottling up the Russian submarine threat. That's where you end up as there. It's the same now. And so, you know, the strategic impact of us not being able to do that. And I would say this at the moment. We are missing the key piece of the jigsaw are doing that, which is our own SSN capability. We don't even have one with our task group. I mean, that's extraordinary. That we don't have enough to spare. We got maybe half of one running now. So we need to get back into that Grid Alliance UK gap business. We're doing it through Atlantic Bastion and all this entire jigsaw, and it is a jigsaw, but take away the SSNs and you cannot do it effectively. And so a delay to the AUKUS SSN would directly impact on the one thing that we should be excel at, historically have, we should now excel at, and actually, of course, our allies really want us to excel at.
Sophia, Steve Timms from BAE Systems told the Commons Defence Committee last week his concerns are mainly around the speed of decision-making. Clearly, to finish programmes on time, we need to start on time, he said. Is it as simple as that?
It's interesting because I think one of the big cultural shifts that has come out of the SDR is government acknowledging that its procurement and decision-making infrastructure is inadequate, and also that the constant revision of requirements is really not productive. But also what I'm seeing, which does feel like a bit of a shift, is that government is also making much clearer demands of industry to say, okay, we're going to try and get at this procurement problem, but we're also expecting much better from you guys in terms of productivity around delivery, quality and timeline. So it has to be on both sides. When I've been trying to sort of look into some of these key obstacles, these blockages around AUKUS, particularly on Pillar 2, you end up in this kind of rabbit hole of buck passing. So I think the point is that all sides need to move. Obviously, industry is right to point out government's role in this. And I think what is becoming increasingly apparent is that when you have these kind of doom loops where everybody is sort of trapped in this cycle of buck passing over responsibility and both sides need to move, sometimes you actually need a third party to come in and mediate and unblock these challenges.
Well, before we discuss the next what if, let's get some perspective from Australia. It is there that AUKUS represents the most radical shift. Going from diesel to nuclear submarines is a bit like changing from being a sprinter to a marathon runner. The training, the skills, support required are completely different. Conversion is a huge endeavour. Colonel John Blaxland, a former Australian military intelligence officer, then defence attaché, is now Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies at the Australian National University.
Here's the thing that most people don't seem to quite get, is that for Australia, diesel electric submarines no longer are fit for purpose. This is a phenomenon that's pretty well unique to Australia, of the countries that don't currently have nuclear propulsion submarines, that is, because for Australia, from the submarine base we have, the only one we have in Perth, to transit to any other capital city, just to Darwin or Adelaide or anywhere else around Australia, let alone going abroad, just to get to another port, you have to recharge the batteries multiple times, more than a dozen times to get to Darwin, say. And each time you do so, you have to put your funnel up, and that funnel generates a wake, a V-shaped wake in the ocean. And nowadays, with almost saturation low Earth orbit satellites, coupled with 30-plus years of pattern analysis for how we've used our diesel-electric submarines, coupled with artificial intelligence and then armed drones, the bottom line is that in a serious stoush, you're cooked. It's not feasible. It doesn't work. You won't get to your destination. The only way around that, the only way to circumvent that limitation, is to actually stay underwater. The only way to do that is with nuclear propulsion.
So if we look at the potential delays, though, to AUKUS, starting with the possibility of not getting Virginia-class submarines from the US, how great is the risk that the 2028 election, AUKUS, could become a casualty?
So I don't think that's all that likely. We've seen both houses and both sides of the aisle in both houses in the United States Congress strongly endorse AUKUS. We've seen succession of presidents strongly endorse AUKUS. And I think there's a factor here which probably hasn't perhaps been given enough weight in people's calculations about what might happen next. And that is the utility of having Australia as an integral partner of the United States in any contingencies in the Indo-Pacific, particularly the deterrent effect of having Australia as a base, having some nuclear propulsion submarines operating in and from Australia. That hugely complicates any prospects of aggressive action elsewhere. And let's face it, we all want to avoid war. So to do that, you need to make any potential aggressor think that it's the cost is too high, and the prospects of success are too low. And having Australia, from an American point of view, having Australia as a base from which it can operate significantly enhances its ability to complicate potential planning for any scenarios in Southeast Asia. And here we, you know, people talk about Taiwan, but there's other scenarios. There's other contingencies. My colleague Brendan Taylor talked about four flashpoints: the Korean Peninsula, the East China Sea, the South China Sea, and the Taiwan issue. So, but there's more than that even.
But from the Australian point of view, one suggestion is that Donald Trump may attach strings to any US submarines, committing Australia to joining any US military action in the region. Is that something any Australian government could or would sign up to?
So, you know, that's a hypothetical. It hasn't happened. It's also one that I think there's a fairly robust counterpoint to that. And I've argued and I've written about this, that we should not be committing in advance to the defense of Taiwan. It's not in the terms of our alliance with the United States, and it's unnecessary, and it's perhaps even harmful to deliberations that might happen in a crisis and helping to resolve the crisis and prevent a crisis from escalating. Having that kind of guarantee could actually mess things up, I think. But historically, do you really need that kind of commitment from Australia? I mean, look what we've done for the last 100 years. Where have we been? We already work incredibly intimately with the United States, particularly with Indo-Pacific Command. Submarines of the Australian Navy operate very closely with their American counterparts. What more do you want? You know, I just think it's a specious argument.
An alternative suggestion, though, is that if the Virginia-class submarines are delayed for whatever reason or blocked by the US, is extending plans for US and UK subs to patrol from Australia. Would that be an acceptable compromise?
So it's not an optimal compromise, but, you know, if the delay in the manufacturing of additional submarines is accentuated further, if we don't actually see the projected rise in productivity, then it's not inconceivable that there could be a delay and perhaps a reduction. It's not one that anybody wants to really contemplate. But even if that is to happen, let's just worst case it for a minute, that we don't get them anytime soon, we'd still get a rotation of US and UK submarines operating out of Submarine Rotation Force West, right? And what's the point of all of this? Well, ideally for Australia, we want our independent capability, but we want the deterrent effect. That's what we want. We want the deterrent effect of nuclear propulsion submarines that are undetectable operating out of Perth in the Indian Ocean, in and around Australia's coastline, significantly bolstering the complication to any adversary's planning about acting against Australia and its interests. And that's generated by having those submarines, American, British, and or Australian flagged submarines operating out of Perth. It's much better from a national security and a self-reliance and a kind of national pride perspective to have our own that are crewed and operated and captained by Australians with an Australian flag. But, you know, pragmatically speaking, in terms of Australia's interests, the deterrent effect is really very much aligned with having UK and US submarines there anyway.
And just finally, John, to reach that ambition that you outlined of Australia having its own capability of nuclear-propelled submarines, how is Australia doing in terms of building the skills, the infrastructure needed to own, to operate, to maintain nuclear submarines? Because you're starting from scratch, aren't you? And it's a very different set of skills compared to your diesel submarine fleet.
Yeah, no, it is definitely a different set of skills. And look, the government has invested in quite a significant number of scholarships to start the ball rolling, getting people going to school to do engineering and nuclear engineering and learn the craft. That's happening a lot at the moment in the United States. It's happening partly in Australia. We have a limited capacity to educate people in that space at a couple of our universities. There's some of that going on. It needs to accelerate. And I suspect, like most defence projects, the time frame will blow out and we'll have to live with that. One other point, Kate, I might just mention, you know, the people saying the expense is just so prohibitively expensive. And the $368 billion Australian dollars figure that the Defence Minister Richard Marles quoted at the very outset is, I think, a bit misleading, because we're really taking it out of height. We're not adding to it at the moment. And I just make a note that anything over 30 years is a lot of money. Put health, welfare, education, social services, you know, put all them together, it's about $12 trillion over 30 years. Let's compare apples with apples. $368 billion, even if we do spend that amount, is over 30 years not an unreasonable amount to be investing in defence, mindful, of course, that defence is all about mitigating the risks of the prospect of war, and war is many times more expensive than the insurance policy of defence.
And that is a very good point to end on. Professor John Blaxland, it's been great speaking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Great to be with you, Kate. Thank you.
Sophia, we're only a couple of years away from US and UK nuclear subs routinely operating from Perth. How much work needs to be done at that base to ensure that's possible?
Well, it's quite a lot. And I think it's fair to say that there are concerns in the UK about whether or not Australia is on schedule with the work that needs to be done from its side. And, you know, I think it's very interesting because in Australia, the debate around AUKUS is very much focused on the United States relationship, which has always been at the heart of its kind of post-war identity question. So it's a very political question. The relationship with Britain, which is obviously the anchor of the SSN AUKUS endeavor, is much less visible. I think that's problematic on a number of levels. And, you know, I think there is a degree to which that bilateral relationship can provide greater resilience underpinning the project and could actually help with some of the public narratives. But it's also true that we need a lot of attention on that exchange because, I think from the British side, we are investing a lot in helping Australia to build this sovereign capability. It is a bit of a risk on our part, not least of all, because we are having to send some of our most highly qualified and extremely scarce, very skilled engineers and other technicians down to Australia to help them build this capability. And we obviously have had some come up to Barrow as well. And there are all sorts of elements of the kind of trilateral competition that haven't really been dealt with. I mean, there is a risk that some of these people don't want to come back to the United Kingdom. So I think it's actually important to get that a bit more out in the open. But certainly, I think what we need to see from the Australian government moving forward is this national mission framing around AUKUS, because this is a generational program in terms of to develop those skills and capabilities. You need to be starting at the lowest levels of the education system. You know, you really have to start early. You can't just sort of tinker around the edges with something like this. So I think we would like to see a little bit more you know, momentum behind that. And that unfortunately requires the Prime Minister to be coming out and directing the system.
And Tom, those Navy exchange programs for training are part of the deal. It started last year with 9 Australians embedded into the Royal Navy Submarine Officer Nuclear Training Pipeline. Naval nuclear propulsion training has been given to more than 250 personnel in Australia. Is that enough at this stage?
I think it's probably, we're probably at the limit of our capacity. I mean, this reminds me a little bit of Ukrainians coming to Sandhurst to learn about sort of infantry tactics. At what point do we go, at what point are we no longer credible in terms of that training? I mean, particularly when it comes to the warfighting of this submarine. At some point, US and UK methodologies for fighting submarines will clash. They're quite different. Put crudely, they put a much higher emphasis in the engineering capability from their command perspective. Our commanders spend much more time fighting the boat in their careers prior to command. So these will all converge, and our ability to train Australia and provide advice, you know, it's grim to say, but where's our credibility now in this? Where's our cadre of perisher trade, command qualified SSN heroes of the high north that can confidently stride into Australia and go, this is how you run a nuclear submarine? That worries me, I think. So the great sort of package that Sophia described is exactly right, and that has to move quickly. But when it gets to the really pointy end, you know, that troubles me too.
And Tom, just briefly, on the war fighting training, how different is that from nuclear to diesel? Because they do have their own sub-war fighting doctrine.
Whilst it's very hard to overstate the complexity of nuclear submarines, it's also very hard to overstate the difference in complexity between diesel boats and nuclear boats. It's like having the most advanced car in the world. You open the bonnet and you can't touch anything versus, you know, a Triumph Spitfire that you can one spanner and you can fix it. I mean, it's that level of difference. So they will have command qualified captains in the Collins class. Collins class is not a bad boat. They're getting old. I mean, they could well be over 40 years if AUKUS is delayed at all. And most diesel boats over history drop off at the 40-year point. So again, we get to the sort of timeliness of all this. But they have an infrastructure that works. They work these boats well. They've overcome all the teething problems largely that they had with them. So from junior rating to senior rating to junior officer to commanding officer, these pyramids are in place. They'll just need to adjust them and adjust the training methodology, but at no point underestimate putting a nuclear kettle in the middle of that boat. It might look the same. It might look like a black tube, but in reality, it's a vastly different beast and needs to be treated very, very differently.
And not everyone agrees with John Blaxland that Australia has to have nuclear subs. While officially there is a broad cross-party support, there is a lot of individual opposition across parties. This is arguably a choice, isn't it, Mike?
Yes. I mean, as John Blaxland was saying, if Australia is to have a credible submarine fleet for its own defence and deterrence, then given where Australia is on the map, then it has to be nuclear. Nothing else makes any sense. So it's a challenge that you've got to rise to. But if Australia didn't want to rise to that challenge, then it would have to rethink what it is trying to achieve with its security and defence policy, because the SSNs are fundamental, more fundamental than anything they do with the Air Force or their Army. Their SSN programme is more fundamental to their own security for the next 50 or 80 years.
Okay, if I could just now get a final thought from each of you. This is ultimately about capability, deterrence and limiting our adversaries. It's one of many strategic levers we have. If AUKUS doesn't go to plan, will it be strategically damaging or just awkward, Sophia?
Profoundly damaging for a number of reasons. Firstly, very quickly, I believe that AUKUS will probably be the primary co-creation allied project that survives under the Trump administration. And it's part of the reason I'm actually optimistic about where we could go under the Trump administration. But I think that is extremely important, not just for Britain and Australia, but actually for the wider allies as well. So if we can succeed at AUKUS and provide a proof of concept in terms of this way of working together, then there are much wider benefits to be had. I also think that it just comes back to this point. The capabilities of Pillar 2, these are the most vital areas of strategic competition with China and other adversaries. Pillar 1, I mean, this is our just crucial home region vital defense. So if we fail at either or both of these pillars, then we've ultimately failed to protect ourselves. So I really think we should stop being asking the question about whether AUKUS as a discrete project fails and really focus more on the entire kind of defense endeavor and the resources that are required to deliver on that.
Tom?
It's AUKUS is absolutely essential to our continued security. It's so big and so potentially so positive, it must succeed, but it's so complex and bring in all the different part, you can very easily say, how can it succeed? For it to, we have to make it a whole ship sport. As Sophia said, this isn't an out of sight, out of mind thing. This is a cross-government cooperation. But how often have we seen that succeed in recent years? You know, not often. I've seen 15 reviews in defense procurement in my time in the Navy. They've all said the same thing. We've got to change this. And nothing changes. We need a doge. Now, I don't think the National Armament Director, 2 weeks in post, is probably thinking that way. In fact, I guarantee he isn't, or he wouldn't have been hired. But that's what we need. We need to shift our risk appetite and our culture. Otherwise, AUKUS will descend into a doom loop, a trilateral doom loop, out of which we can't escape. And we have to not fall into that hole. And underpinning all of this is actual proper money, not 2.5%. next year or 2.7%, it's actual money now. Our defense chiefs today are wrestling with what capabilities they need to cut to meet this round of in-year savings. You put that against AUKUS, you know, how can it possibly work? But as I've said, it has to work. So somebody has to smash these two things together. And maybe that is the President of the United States. I don't know.
Mike.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I don't think this deal will go down. I think it will succeed, maybe not as straightforwardly as we would like, but I don't think it will go down. And I was thinking as we were speaking, if it did go down as a deal, it would be like the old blue streak issue of the late 1950s, early 60s. You know, blue streak was a missile system, a nuclear missile system that we were buying from the Americans, and we mortgaged our force to do that. And then the Americans cancelled it. But the Americans then felt so guilty about it that they gave us a really good deal on Polaris, a really good deal. And out of Polaris came the Vanguard, the Trident system and Vanguard. And, you know, the Vanguard program, our present program, is the only really big program that came in under budget and on time. Really big project. And it did what it was supposed to do. It's one of the very, very few examples of a really big project that was under budget and on time. So the collapse of Blue Streak actually had a very favourable ultimate outcome. But that was because the United States was a different United States in those days than the one it is now. And the relationship between Britain and the United States in those days, we're talking about Macmillan and Kennedy here, is very different to the relationship that we can anticipate in the next 10 years. So if AUKUS goes down for some horrible reason as a big project, I don't think there'll be a happy outcome afterwards.
I'm sure we will be returning to this subject again and again. Sophia Gaston, Tom Sharp, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, just before we go, a reminder that we have an extra edition of the SITREP podcast online now. Mike and Sean have been talking to the master military storyteller, Bernard Cornwell. He has just published Sharp Storm, the 25th Sharp book. He had hinted it would also be the last, except...
If I'm honest with myself, I think 3 or 4 years from now, I'll suddenly hear that voice in my head saying, hey, let me out. Yeah. And I'd do another one.
But Uhtred is still with you?
Uhtred is still with me, and I'm actually writing one now with him. And after him, I don't know what.
Can you tell us anything more about what you're writing now then with Uhtred?
Well, one I shouldn't be writing, really, because it's another one which the first one with Uhtred, that goes back to the middle of his life. And what I'm having him do is something really quite extraordinary. And I'm not going to tell you what it is because it gives away too much. But everyone's going to wonder, why doesn't he ever mention this again? You know, this big life-changing event. And he never talks about it. And I did it with Sharp so much. And, you know, I get letters from people saying, you killed Rifleman Tongue in XYZ book. And he's alive again 3 books later. And I think, okay, damn, I made a mistake.
Oh, it sounds like you had some fun there, Mike.
Yes, we did. And I had a great conversation with him off camera before we started and then a little bit after we finished, because I was talking to him about a lot of the other books that he's written. I've read them all. So we talked about the books about the American War of Independence, the fort, and the books about the American Civil War, and books about the Hundred Years' War and some of the medieval stuff he's done. And I said to him, I said, you know, Bernard, we were talking about Uhtred at that point and the Last Kingdom. And I said, Bernard, you've got a great sense of Anglo-Saxon England. You do seem to have that, you imbibe the sense of Anglo-Saxon England, because I've written about that myself, and I really respect what he conveys about the Anglo-Saxon England and the Britain of those days. And he said, yes. He said, although I've lived in the States for a very long time and I'm married to an American woman, he said, the voice inside my head, the voice I write with, is a very English voice. And I think that's absolutely true. And it reminded me of that sort of, it's a truism that, you know, a good writer has got to know a great deal more about what they're writing about than they put on the page. But a really great writer has not just got to know more, they've got to feel it. They've really got to feel it. And I mean, Bernard has created this, you know, this is a genre of historical novels. And they're, you know, they're rip-roaring adventure novels of a hero. So it's boy's own stuff in one sense. But what makes them so popular is their sense of historical accuracy, of a historical time and place. And I thought then, that's what it is, Bernard. That's what it is about you, that you feel what you know. And it shows in the way you write.
That's very interesting. And you can watch the whole thing for yourself on the BFBS Forces News YouTube channel, or listen by searching for BFBS SITREP wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, Mike. And we'll be back with another SITREP next Thursday. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.